This is Radio Eco Shock with Alex Smith.
We're prisoners in a fairy tale, a ship of fools all set to sail. We watch the Empire's epic fail on shiny handheld screens. The rapture of the buy and sell, the faithful at the wishing well. They rage against the infidel lurking in their dreams.
That was a clip from Texas songwriter Eliza Gilkyson. The song is In the Name of the Lord. I will speak with Eliza later this hour and end with another song from this inspiring artist. We talk about getting through the hardest of times. Last week, the Prime Minister of Italy declared that country had reached its darkest hour. One of the best medical hospital systems in the world, with more beds and doctors per capita than in the United States, Canada, or Britain, in Italy they cracked under the load of severe cases of the virus called Corona, or COVID-19. This week, New York State Governor Andrew Cuomo told New Yorkers they are the next Italy. In dangerous times, real leaders tell their people the hard truth. At the start of the Second World War, Winston Churchill promised Britain's years of blood and loss, not love and recovery. The truth is that all of Europe and North America have been blown up. The bomb is not just this novel coronavirus. That is just the fuse that lit it. The bomb is the overblown consumer economy which believed money was endless, nature was to be used, and stocks could only go up. We cannot continue with the fossil-powered economy anyway, because our pollution is spinning the climate out of control. Our greed for resources is snuffing out the species in a mass extinction. The whole show cannot continue. If we try to go back to that normal, there will never be a good and stable future for any foreseeable generation. Think about that. This is our final warning and our chance literally to reform, to reform into a fair and sustainable society. There is a way out, but it is not the way we came.
Order falls apart. Nothing is as it seems, and all of the like minds who reel from this blow to the heart. Time for leaving the lands of the beautiful light. As we gaze into the future on the night of the supermoon.
A month ago, in the middle of February, I warned Radio EcoShock listeners to prepare for long-term isolation at home while the coronavirus rages through Europe and North America. A few people wrote back suggesting that was overblown, just alarmism. Now we see. Our family laid aside enough food to hold out for 3 months, at least until the spring growing season, when the garden could start to help feed us. Why so long? Several reasons. First, there is an unknown time when this insidious disease is multiplying inside your community, but people have not yet developed symptoms. That period alone could be up to 2 weeks, experts say. It is a real challenge for each of us to judge when is the time to pull the plug and self-isolate, especially when mass testing is not happening and the authorities are also waiting for symptoms to show. Even then, we often don't get good information, and sometimes we get very bad information from the government. In testimony to Congress, one representative of the Trump administration said there was no need for Americans to stockpile food. Most of us didn't listen to that. Just a week and a half later, we hear Dr. Marty Makary of the Johns Hopkins Bloomberg School of Public Health speaking on CNBC March 12th.
Look, I think every household, regardless of what politicians and government leaders say, every household should declare a state of emergency get 3 months of food and necessary medications, whatever essential meds somebody might be on, and get ready to hunker down. Look, we're going to see probably over 1,000 deaths per day during the peak of this thing. That's not something we're prepared for.
If your community or region reaches the point of obvious contagion, you should have been home and out of personal contact for 2 weeks already. Then begins a rolling clock which is reset with each new set of infections as the disease rolls towards its peak. When it recedes below community contagion is unknown. Maybe spring weather will dampen down the spread. Maybe the disease will continue until about 80% of all people have been infected, as several U.S. government experts have suggested. Remember, though, that most of those people will not get severely ill, and a large number will not have symptoms. It seems likely to me there will be a pause in the number of sick and dying. People will feel emboldened to come out or sorely need to get back to work to get some income. Corporate owners will want to start up the system again. After the government sounds some sort of back-to-work signal, there could be reinfection and further spread. We don't know. We may find that out when China or South Korea try to restart their economies. Let's watch for that. It also seems likely to me this pestilence, the same virus or a mutated version, could return next fall when weather conditions return to the cool but not super cold conditions this disease appears to favor. We could have a second or third wave of infection, as happened during the Spanish flu of 2018 and 2019. The second wave was more deadly than the first. We may have to live with endemic COVID-19 until a vaccine is delivered to the majority of the public, and that will take a year to a year and a half. So we have to live with this for a while. With all the uncertainty, my best guess and guide for our household is to isolate for at least 1 month, possibly three, and then get out and grow as much food as we can while keeping social contacts to a minimum. You will probably try to assess who is safe and who has traveled in from another area or broken their isolation. Let's talk about emergency gardening. In the spring of the Northern Hemisphere, we will cover our property with vegetables, including containers on the driveway. We will have enough seed because we did put lots of seed away. We may also make arrangements to grow food on nearby properties, sharing the harvest with those owners. Tear up the lawn, plant potatoes or whatever produce will grow best in your area, give the most food value, and some that can be stored for the winter. The first aim is to provide fresh greens in the early spring to supplement the stored foods we've been eating for a couple of months. Even lettuce or sprouts grown in a window in your home can do that. You can also sprout seeds in jars to get healthy greens. If you have not purchased or ordered seeds yet, I recommend you do that now. Get lots, if you can afford it, enough for yourself and your neighbors. The second aim is to be able to store a lot of food for next winter. We do not know how well agriculture and the international shipping regime will recover from this blow by coronavirus. Ports in North America are almost shutting down now because container ships have not arrived from China and because port staff do not want to risk infection that they might take home to their families. Will California and Florida be able to find the seasonal workers to harvest the food? Will some farmers go bankrupt? Will we also suffer more drought and extreme heat events this summer? There are various signals weather extremes could happen, adding to the misery and food challenges of 2020. I touch on one reason for extreme heat in our upcoming interview with Professor Joost Levierveld, and it is connected with the virus and the shutdown. If you can, and as much as you can, you may want to add food insurance for the rest of this year and early 2021. Convert everything you can to growing food. Let's call it a survival garden instead of a victory garden. This should be supplemented by storing other fruits and vegetables as those harvests come in. If possible, spend some of your quarantine time on YouTube learning how to grow and put away food. Learn canning, how to pickle food, how to salt or smoke meat if you eat meat. Check out my catalog of free Radio EcoShock shows on canning, gardening, and survival food. It's at ecoshock.org. You need to maintain a good diet to maintain your immune system, keeping it high, or to recover from this illness if you get it. The government may or may not drop off packs of commercial food low in vitamins. Only you can provide what you really need. We need to go further than individual survival, though. I was stunned to learn that New York City hesitated to close their school system last week because 114,000 homeless children get two meals a day at school. It may be their only food that day. 114,000 kids without homes in one American city, such a rich city. How did that happen? And where would they quarantine? What will those numbers be when the economy takes a big hit? I expect many more. Then we have all the seniors who played their role to make this world, and they may be helpless now. There are the disabled who will not be able to garden or even go out to get food. When it comes to a pandemic, with a new disease never seen before, the health of our weakest people will determine when it is really safe for you to go out and enjoy life with all your friends and loved ones. I hope to grow more food than we need. I hope to be able to get free food out to people around us who need it. The coming summer of 2020 is a time for millions of gardeners. It is time to feed ourselves again. Before we get to our first guest, let's look at just one important new study on this deadly virus. We ask, is a 14-day quarantine enough? How long should a person in contact with carriers of the coronavirus stay isolated? Is the 14 days recommended by the government enough to protect your family and the community? New research published in the Annals of Internal Medicine on March 10th shed some light. First of all, the study led by Stephen Lauer and Kira Grants of Johns Hopkins estimates the incubation period. That is key because this is also how long the virus could be circulating completely unseen in your community. Here is what they found, quote, "The median incubation period was estimated to be 5.1 days, and 97.5% of those who develop symptoms will do so within 11.5 days, end quote. But a few cases could take up to 15 days to show symptoms, they say. So is 14 days enough? They say yes, but with an important qualification. For example, quote, "These estimates imply that under conservative assumptions, 101 out of every 10,000 cases will develop symptoms after 14 days of active monitoring or quarantine." So the 14 days is not airtight. If 100,000 people are in quarantine, and it could be millions, you know, once they start closing down cities, but with 100,000 isolated and then released, over 1,000 of those people could still be infectious and still carry the disease. Maybe that is not important from the perspective of getting citizens back into circulation to keep the economy going, but 1,000 more spreaders sounds like a big problem to me. To be really sure, it sounds like quarantine should be more like 21 days. If a million people are in quarantine for 14 days, which again is possible when cities get locked down, then 10,000 people may still be infectious when they come out of that quarantine. Isolation should really be 21 days. You can find a link to that study in my show blog. Now, on with the show. Get all our previous programs at our website, ecoshock.org. As the burst of coronavirus stops production and travel, the world already suffers another deadly pandemic. It kills more people than smoking, disease, or violence. Most of us breathe it in every day. It is air pollution, and it may shorten your life by several years, according to new science. Because of it, every year millions of people pass away too soon. At the Max Planck Institute in Mainz, Germany, Professor Jules Lelieveld and Thomas Munzel just published the startling results. Let's look at this other pandemic we live with. Could cleaner skies during the Great Quarantine improve our health? Will it cause more warming? Will it inspire us to finally clean up the air? From Mainz, Jules Lelieveld, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Hello, nice to talk to you.
Thank you for joining us. I have looked at maps comparing general air pollution over China compared to this month, when much of the country's travel and industry was shut down by COVID-19. You have been studying the problem of air pollution for decades, really. Did you ever expect to see such a sudden clearing of the skies over East Asia?
Oh, this is really amazing. You can see, especially around Wuhan, that the air has cleared up tremendously. And, of course, this is a sad byproduct of the close down because of the coronavirus. But it also shows the enormous impact of air pollution that we are exposed to every day.
We know global dimming has helped offset the heat we should expect from the emissions we put up there. If we take that pollution away, we would be hotter. Could a prolonged slowdown and reduction of fossil fuel use produce more warming or weather disturbances in the short term or in the long term?
Well, actually, yes. It will affect actually rather in the short term because the pollution particles are relatively short-lived. Once you stop emitting the precursor gases that make the particles, then you'll have immediate effect on the climate and the weather, which means that if you take out the particles, you increase the amount of sunlight that can reach the surface. So it actually causes a warming. But things are a little bit more complicated because if you reduce air pollution, it would be most useful to do this together with reducing greenhouse gases. So, for example, if you switch cars from polluting with particulate air pollution and you switch them to electric cars and you provide this electricity with renewable energy, you would both reduce air pollution, which would warm, and you would reduce greenhouse gases, which would change the amount of warming. There are two effects, actually, that go against each other. But in the end, we will have to reduce greenhouse gases anyway, and we will want to make people healthier by reducing pollution particles anyway also.
Yes, I just noticed that despite satellite measures showing cleaner air, carbon dioxide measured at Mauna Loa on March 9, 2020, spiked to almost 418 parts per million. So is climate-wrecking CO2 operating separately from the air pollution you study?
It operates from the same sources, but the lifetime in the atmosphere of the carbon dioxide is much longer. So it means that what you see now on the 9th of March is the cumulative or the total effect of emissions that have occurred earlier this year. This is not the case for the pollution. For example, the nitrogen dioxide pollution maps that are being shown by NASA or the particulates, because they respond immediately. They have a short lifetime. So the sources are the same, but the lifetime of these pollutants in the atmosphere is different. So their impact is of a different on a different time scale.
The burden of radiation leading to skin cancer is cumulative. It builds up over my lifetime. Is it the same with air pollution, do you know?
Well, I'm not sure if you can directly compare it, but I think it's a very good example because what actually leads to a premature mortality from air pollution is the cumulative or the chronic exposure to it. So you are exposed, 365 days a year, a lifetime long. And it is mostly the elderly that suffer from the impacts. It's the chronic diseases that we typically in high-income countries die from, like cancers and heart disease, etc. And these are the sort of diseases that sort of operate or act on mortality later in life. So this is sort of an enhancement of the risk factors that lead to these chronic diseases.
Jos, how can we call air pollution a pandemic?
Yeah, it is a bit unfortunate that there is a sort of a crossover here with the corona. So we did not have the intent to sort of make corona look harmless, because this is a very serious issue indeed. But it is the fact that air pollution effects are spreading worldwide. People's lives are extended, we are living longer, so we are exposed for a longer period. And the impacts of air pollution are ever increasing in the world and in many, many countries. So according to the exact definition of a pandemic, is a spreading disease regionally or worldwide. And this is actually what is happening with air pollution. So I think the comparison is a fair one.
Although you've worked on these problems since the 1980s, we could begin with your highly cited 2015 paper titled The Contribution of Outdoor Air Pollution Sources to Premature Mortality on a Global Scale. How does your new paper, just published in March 2020, update your previous findings?
Yeah, so first of all, the older work, and in this case, the 2015, is not that old, but it was based on what we call exposure mortality relationships based on epidemiological studies. And more of these studies are becoming available. And the earlier ones that was also relevant for the 2015 study were based mostly on air pollution and health data in North America and in Europe. And the very high concentrations that are relevant in some parts of the world were simply not measured in North America and in Europe. So for these high concentrations, people have used relationships that were taken from secondhand smoking. And so they were extrapolated towards higher concentrations to, for example, account for the air pollution in India and China, where the air quality is much poorer. Now, the newer work makes use of new data sets that have been collected also in these countries, in particular in China. And this shows that actually the effects at higher concentrations are much larger than we had assumed previously. Previously, it was assumed that, for example, if you smoke 15 cigarettes or 20, it doesn't really make much of a difference. But actually, with air pollution, this increase made much more of a difference than from secondhand smoking. So for that reason, we had to recently readjust these mortality numbers, and they are now becoming close to twice as high as the studies that were published previously.
Public health scientists have complained that many deaths triggered by air pollution are not recognized. What goes on the death certificate might be heart attack or stroke, even though more people die during or directly after a period of smog. How confident are you in that average number of 3.3 million global deaths from air pollution annually? Could it be lower or higher?
Well, of course, it could be lower and higher because there is uncertainty. And this uncertainty is substantial, but it is just as substantial as the estimates of the number of people who die from smoking. Because you're absolutely right, it's not on the death certificate that somebody dies from air pollution or smoking or obesity. You know, you die from a heart attack or from a stroke or from a cancer. And what causes these diseases, of course, is not on the death certificate. And this is exactly the information that is being extracted from these epidemiological studies, where people are being followed for decades sometimes and being tracked, you know, what are they being exposed to, what are multiple factors that people are being exposed to, because some people have multiple risks. For example, if you are obese and you smoke and you have high air pollution being exposed to, then these risks become, of course, even more serious. So to disentangle these things, you need a lot of data from these epidemiological studies, which have now become available for more than a million people, actually.
I was surprised in the new study to find the main culprits of deadly air pollution can be so different from one continent to another. If we think traffic and business are the big polluters, say, in California, what is the largest single source of air pollution in Europe?
Well, actually, there's a number of things that play in here. Traffic, of course, is important, but there are also other things because the particles that are so small that they can deeply penetrate the respiratory system, your lungs, are often particles that are being chemically formed in the air. So it means they form from gases that are being emitted by cars, by industries, by agriculture, and then they react in the atmosphere and form these particles. Now, the question, of course, is how do you effectively reduce these particles? And then you have to go back to the sources. And it can very well be that in some areas, for example, the emissions from agriculture, this is ammonia, this smelly stuff that comes out of manure applications, that the reduction of these emissions can be more efficient than the reduction of other industrial or traffic emissions. But this can differ very much from continent to continent and country to country.
So to be clear, from what you just said, it's not that we could measure certain particles that are damaging our health that are coming up from something like manure. It's that gases in the air are getting a chemical reaction, and that produces the particles that could damage our lungs.
Yes, exactly. It's about 70 to 80% of the small particles that damage your lungs are actually formed in the atmosphere. So in order to reduce these, you have to reduce these gases that from which these particles are being formed.
So does air pollution travel around the world? For example, where does China's legendary smog go?
Yes. Well, the lifetime of the particles is roughly a week. And that is barely enough, for example, to cross the Pacific Ocean. So it means that a large fraction of what is being emitted in China and particles being formed from will be rained out during the transit over the Pacific Ocean. But some fraction definitely reaches North America. And this has been shown by measurements also, for example, along the Californian coast.
Some even collect in the Arctic, according to scientists.
Oh, yes, for sure. And in the Arctic, especially in spring, because then you have air masses coming out of Northern Europe and Asia. And Russia, for example, polluted air that can reach the Arctic, for sure.
What level of air pollution is safe for human health? How much can we tolerate?
That is a very good question, and unfortunately not so easy to answer. I can just give you the World Health Organization has a guideline, and this guideline is 10 micrograms of particulates per cubic meter. And these are particulates that have a diameter less than 2.5 micrometer. So we call these fine aerosol particles. And these particles can actually, this is now from new studies, be damaging even below this threshold. So for that reason, in Canada, for example, the threshold now, the air quality standard is actually 10 micrograms according to the WHO standard, but the plans are to reduce them further. And the same is being done in Australia, where the air quality standards are even stricter. And the absolute level where we can be sure that there is no effect is of the order of a few micrograms per cubic meter. So that's substantially less than this recommendation by the WHO. And this was taken, for example, from a study, a very recently published study in the United States, where they have looked at millions of people who receive Medicare. They have looked at the data, and they have looked at the exposure maps over the United States, and they have seen that there is also damage, health damage from air pollution in the Medicare community, well below these levels. So to cut it short, the absolute safe level is only a few micrograms per cubic meter, but in order to reach that, one would need to really take very strong and probably economically damaging measures. But we have to go at least below this 10 micrograms per cubic meter.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with Professor Jos Lelieveld from the Max Planck Institute in Germany. We are discussing new science on the pandemic of air pollution, killing millions every year. We imagine air pollution around large cities where we can see it in the air, sometimes even taste it. Can peaceful-looking rural areas also experience dangerous air pollution?
Well, actually, it does. Usually, the air in cities is more polluted than in the rural environment, but actually not that much because, as I have explained earlier, the particles are being formed in the air during their transport and because of chemical reactions. And of course, this can take some time, sometimes days, even weeks. So in that period, the air is being moving around for sometimes up to 100 or hundreds of kilometers. So it means that the pollution, even though many of the sources are in and around the city, like industries and energy and production and traffic, etc. But these pollutants mix with the stuff that comes out of the countryside, like the ammonia from agriculture, and it forms a large cloud of pollutants that is not only limited to the city boundaries.
Here in North America, we like to think Europe is more advanced in legislation for environmental protection. What is the reality when it comes, though, to air pollution standards?
Well, this is definitely not the case for air pollution standards. In Canada, the standard is now 10 micrograms. In the United States, it's 12. And these are averages per year. And in Europe, it's 25. So this is one of the things that we really want to point out with our new studies, is that this 25 micrograms per cubic meter is 2.5 times higher than the WHO guideline. And even that is much higher than is desirable for really clean air conditions. So the European air quality standards are absolutely insufficient to protect people from air pollution, and they need to be adjusted.
In the recent coronavirus pandemic, a young taxi driver in Thailand died, but he also had dengue fever. Could you talk to us about the different roles of the underlying public health situation in various parts of the world when it comes to the results of air pollution?
Yes, these are the sorts of things that also play a role with air pollution. A precondition, of course. Let me give you one example. And children have the lungs of children are quite sensitive to pollutants, and children can suffer, for example, from pneumonia. And in many countries of the world, children die from pneumonia, especially in low income countries like in Africa or South Asia. But children who will suffer from air pollution, even leading to a pneumonia in Canada, the United States, or in Europe, tend to not die from these diseases. And this simply has to do with a better level of nutrition, better health care, better medical care. So it means that if medical and health care in general are less, then of course the risk of being affected by pollutants is higher. And accordingly, the mortality that is associated with it is also higher. So for that reason, we find the highest mortality rates in sub-Saharan Africa.
Last year, you published a paper estimating the effects of removing emissions from the air. Suppose we do build a clean energy economy with best practices agriculture. What happens?
Well, this makes especially the fossil emissions play an enormously important role in North America. In Europe, actually, the agricultural emissions are relatively more important. But in North America, about 80% of the pollution is avoidable. And of that, about 80 to 90% is related to fossil fuels. So making the transition from fossil to clean renewable energy in North America would have an enormously positive impact on the air quality.
As we know from the pioneering work of V. Ramanathan, a huge and deadly air pollution in India came not only from heavy industry, but from micro sources, from people at home. Could you tell us about that?
Yes, this is what we call residential energy use. And this is in India, it's basically the burning of solid fuels in cook stoves. And this is wood or whatever they can find to burn stuff, even cow dung, which is extremely polluting. And it causes household air pollution. But much of it is done in the outdoor environment, and it creates a lot of outdoor air pollution as well. And since so many people do that in India, it creates an enormous, what they call, brown cloud, and pollution levels are really very high because of it. More than half of the air pollution in India is related to these relatively small sources related to household energy use.
Jos Lelieveld, you are a professor of chemistry at one of the most prestigious institutes, succeeding the legendary Paul Kreutzen. Is it your feeling that students in Germany or the Netherlands are pessimistic about our future climate?
Well, I think they're very worried. I'm not sure if they're pessimistic, but they are worried, and they should be, because of course the climate change is something that has a much longer perspective than air pollution. If you stop air polluting today, then next week the air will be clean. But this is not the case for climate change because of the lifetime of the carbon dioxide, which is much longer. So young people are now standing up and telling us older people, you know, you don't want to pick up your bad habits and continue doing this. And they request and they require, actually, that policies are being adjusted, not only to clean the air, but also reduce greenhouse gas emissions and prevent climate change from becoming an even much bigger problem than it already is.
What would you like to see done to get healthier air to breathe?
I actually think it would make a lot of sense to not only do what we call end-of-pipe cleaning. So we have done that in the past. Like, you know, we have cars, we've equipped them with catalyzers and better systems to clean the air, clean the exhaust before it actually pollutes the air. That, of course, helps, but it does not prevent carbon dioxide emissions. And it makes a lot of sense to try to really get into more clean and renewable energy use to both clean up the air and also reduce climate change. So this is a tendency that is now catching up. I think the car industry is now picking up on this, at least it is in Germany. It is late, but perhaps and hopefully not too late. And I think the young generation justifiably requires that more is being done in this area.
On one other quick topic, what in your study of atmospheric chemistry led you to predict, quote, strongly increasing heat extremes in the Middle East and North Africa in the 21st century?
Yeah, that's another study that we performed, and this was based actually on model results or model projections that are being used for the IPCC. So we first looked at, you know, can the models actually predict, can they actually reproduce the measurements of temperature in the Middle East and North Africa? And we focus on this area because it's already very hot there. And we saw that the models actually do an excellent job in simulating or calculating these heat extremes in the present day climate. And then we looked at the model projections for the future and saw that especially in summer, when heat extremes, of course, are more relevant than in winter, that the warming is much stronger than anywhere else in the world. So that means in an area where it's already hot and dry, the rate of heating, the speed of climate change is much faster than in many other places of the world. And that has a big impact also on health, because heat extremes are actually the meteorological phenomenon that causes most premature death. So we often tend to think in extremes in terms of storms, and of course hurricanes are devastating. But if you look at what are the sort of weather extremes where most people die from, and that's heat extremes. So by combining this, one can actually predict, you know, with relatively good confidence that North Africa and the Middle East will be very hard hit by climate change in terms of heat extremes.
As we wrap up here, what are you working on now?
Well, one of the things that is critically being discussed on the in the air pollution area is that we are assuming that all particles are equally toxic. And this is because epidemiological studies do not give us any clues about certain sources being more toxic than others. But there now are becoming more and more studies that show that, for example, brakeware and certain sources of metals in the air may be more toxic than others, also black carbon. So we're now trying to study, you know, if these sources of air pollution are more toxic than others, what would that mean in terms of policy strategies to help clean the air? It's something that we are working on at the moment.
From the Max Planck Institute for Chemistry and Mainz, Germany, we've been speaking with Professor Jos Lelieveld. He is the lead author of the paper published in the journal Cardiovascular Research on March 2nd. The title is Loss of Life Expectancy from Air Pollution Compared to Other Risk Factors, A Worldwide Perspective. Find links in my show blog at ecoshock.org. Dr. Lelieveld, thank you so much for sharing your valuable time with us.
You're most welcome, and thank you for your interest.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
Check out the Radio EcoShock website. We're at ecoshock.org.
The center cannot hold. This is somebody else's dream. Out of the nighttime, lifelines glow in the dark.
There is so much news to be told. Music can still break through that. And I first found songwriter and performer Eliza Gilkyson during the 2008 financial crash. Her song Runaway Train captured our time perfectly, and it still does. Coming out of Texas, Eliza finds the artful way to capture the enormity of what is happening. And it is fit that we reach out to her again as things seem to be collapsing and as she releases her really inspiring new album, 2020. From Austin, Texas, Eliza Gilkyson, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Great to be with you today.
Yeah, well, here's where I'd like to start. You know, lost in this whirlwind of news about the pandemic and the stock market crash, there was a real whirlwind that struck and killed so many in the heart of country music, and I'm talking about that extra strong tornado that ripped through Tennessee on March 3rd, left 24 dead. And any other time, this would have been a national time of mourning and a big news story, but it's gotten lost. Eliza, what have you heard out of Nashville?
Well, I have a lot of friends there, and they're in shock. But they are an amazing community. I think mostly what I hear now is that the community is just really banding together, doing benefits. It's a very deep music community as well, and so everybody, they love that city so much, and they love all their friends, and so I think there's a real sense of rallying and taking care of their own.
Yeah, my listeners know that kind of extreme weather is made worse by climate change. But staying with Nashville, you know, like every other city in America, there are a lot of homeless people there, and the administration right now is talking about cuts in payroll taxes or government bailouts for the airline or the hotel industry. And there's nothing to get homeless people tested and treated and fed, and if we don't do that, this pandemic will just roll over us. Now, look, it's a lot to ask, but Eliza, I'm hoping that you can roll out some music for all those millions of Americans that have been left out. What do you think?
I hope I speak for a lot of people who feel helpless, who are grieving, who are angry, and who really want to come together in a unified front to stop this administration.
Yeah, you know, listening to your music, just what you just said, some of your songs rock it out with sort of a mixture of anger and love, which I really appreciate. But some of your other songs are the saddest. There's a real sense of longing and of loss. Do you go through those kinds of moods as you write and as you look around?
I think if you're not grieving right now, then you're just not tuned into what's really happening. I mean, every day, you know, the species lost, people are suffering. There's so much going on that is so painful. But it's an epic situation that's going on in the world today. It's just an epic tragedy is really what's happening. And I think we're all in various stages of denial about it because we have to get up every day and go about our business of being alive. And I think what's happening today is that so many people are so upset, they're frightened, they're sad, they're grieving, and if you're not allowing yourself to feel how sad this is, because this is an epic tragedy that's unfolding in our country and in the world, between the environment, the species loss, the climate change, the threat to the planet's survival, to all the animals and nature and flora and fauna that will suffer, there is no way that you, if you acknowledge what's happening, if you're not in denial, that you don't feel grief about it. And I think before you can even act sensibly, it's a good idea to process the anger and the grief and channel those things into action. So I with my record, especially with this one, I even started out, this record starts out with a fairly, it's an honest sense of sorrow, of the state of affairs. And then from there, I move out into what can we do, you know, and I start to write these songs that are about getting on the front lines and really singing and putting community together and unifying with a unified sense of purpose. But that doesn't mean that we're not in a grievous situation.
Yeah, it's amazing how music, well, they say the blues can actually make you feel better, but music can bring us together and it can allow us to feel things without flattening us into bed where we can't get up anymore. You know, I just love what music can do for us.
I agree. We have to be able to remain sentient while all this stuff is going on, because if we lose our that sense of compassion and feeling and caring in order to cope with how frightening and sad all this is, if we shut down, then we've lost. We're going to lose, you know, the battle. So we have to stay sentient, and I think music is really one of the very safe ways to go ahead and let yourself process all these feelings. I think it's one of the best ways we have, one of the best vehicles we have right now for processing emotion.
I agree, but the music industry is also going to take a hit. I mean, major concerts have been canceled across the country. New York City announced Broadway theaters will be closed. I guess you won't be touring anytime soon. Maybe your next song will come out on YouTube or something.
Yeah, we're actually looking at, you know, how, because I've got a record coming out literally that just, and a tour is all planned for this spring, and this record really is just this record is really just tailor-made for 2020. It's not like this is, I really made this record for an election year. So I do want to get it out there. I really hope that we stay in the voting process. I worry about that more than concerts. I mean, we've got to be able to vote, and, you know, that involves being around a lot of people. So I'm more concerned about that right now.
Yeah, that's important. And this will be a time of loss for sure. I mean, some companies will close, some institutions will fail, but it could be a turning point where we get together more as a society to know that everyone counts and to make things work better. Are you still hopeful that we could see a new dawn after some dark times?
You know, I don't want to be negative, because I have to, you know, I have to be hopeful every day myself just to live, you know, but I think the train has left the station on what's going to happen with climate change, and it's going to be more about challenging ourselves to be decent and aware and compassionate human beings. And if there is any hope, it is in that we will be kind to each other and share, and we will have to cut back in such an extreme way of consumption that systems will fail. And so we're going to have to figure out how to live with each other and how to behave with each other and how to share. And so if we can do that, then maybe there is a path through for us. So I certainly hold out for that. My work is really just to make sure that people stay centered and stay compassionate, because we want to be the best that we can be in the worst of times. If we can do that, there's always room for hope when people behave, when they're the best that they can be, when they behave carefully for each other and compassionately for each other. So there is that possibility, and I think that kind of compassion crosses political lines. It's just, are you that kind of person that will help somebody else? You know, I think it's going to come down to that. You know, what are we, decent human beings? If we are, then I think there's going to be a way through.
I guess you began in Texas, didn't you?
Well, I certainly started putting out my records in this last part of my life there. I wasn't born in Texas, but I've been here since the end of the 90s.
And for me, it seemed like you were blossoming at a time when another sort of Texan, George Bush, ran the country. And it sounded brave to me at the time that you took so many progressive stands. Of course, I have to remember that Austin has a lot of progressive people, too. But was it hard then?
It was very hard, because it was before the Dixie Chicks. I put out music that was very much condemning that administration and the war. So I got actually a frightening, mail. And at the time, it was, nobody was doing it. Everybody was strangely silent. So it was a little frightening. Now everybody's on board, you know, so I think there's a lot of music that's addressing a lot of the different issues today. And I think the young people have really picked it up. When I was putting out stuff during the Bush administration, the young people hadn't jumped on board yet, but they've taken the ball and they're running with it now in music.
One of my favorite songs of yours from that time, I think, is "Man of God."
Yeah, I got a lot of heat for it, but I got a lot of support too, especially in Canada. Wow, I first played that up in Canada before I was even really playing in the U.S. I did some shows up in Canada, and man, they just freaked out. They gave me a lot of courage and encouragement to come back to the States and sing this political music.
Yes, indeed. Where do you see yourself going now?
I think I'm old enough that I've got to slow down. I want to keep making music to the end of my life, so I just need to pace myself. But every record is sort of a concept record to me, so I don't know what the next one's going to be. This one was obviously catered to an election year. The 2020 record is obviously catered to an election year, so I wrote stuff that was really appropriate for that. But after that, I think, once again, I'm going to mostly what I just try to write about is just urging people to stay sentient.
Yeah, I find with my show, I'm not always sure what direction it's going to take, and it sort of gets pulled out of me by the times that I'm living in. So,
I have that same experience, yeah.
It's hard to predict the future, especially these days. I mean, it just seems like anything is possible.
Yeah, well, that is really true. That is really true. We're going to have to, in a global sense, we're going to have to really, really unite to push back against this entrenched power.
Well, I want to wrap this up because I want to leave a little time to play another one of your tunes that I love, but could you tell our listeners how they can find you on the net or follow you on social media?
Well, they can. I'm there on Twitter. I'm there on Facebook. And I also have a website where you can sign up for my mailings, ElizaGilkison.com. I'm on Red House Compass Records on that label, and there'll be pre-ordering my new record, the 2020. So I think you can find me all those ways. Thank you for asking.
Well, I'm just going to help you out and spell your last name for people who are going to Google it. So it's GILKYSON, Gilkyson. So for sure, tune into that, because I have a feeling, Eliza, that with these red-hot times we're living in, and perhaps your inability to tour right away, we might see some new music come out even on top of your new album.
That's true. I'm sitting around here just figuring out how to stay creative.
If we're all in quarantine, we'll have lots of time to listen to you.
Yeah, thank goodness for social media. I mean, I think the internet there's going to be a lot of communication through that one vehicle.
I'm afraid so. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Thank you, Alex.
If you have a story idea or thoughts on something you've heard, contact us, radio@ecoshock.org. That's radio@ecoshock.org.
There is tons of great music on Eliza Gilkyson's new album, 2020. It's an album for this year, for this time. I encourage you to get it wherever music is sold. But right now, I've got to play you my all-time favorite song of hers. It's called Runaway Train. It's from the 2008 album Beautiful World. And for me, this encapsulates where our civilization has been, where it's gone, and where we have to leave behind. I'm Alex Smith. This is Radio EcoShock. Tune in again next week and get all our good stuff at ecoshock.org. Thank you for listening.
Tons of hurtling steel, screaming round the curve, nobody at the wheel. Everyone said don't pay it any mind, there's a pot of gold waiting at the end of the line. Just move with the eye of the hurricane, we'll never get off of this runaway train. Everyone pitiful few sound the alarm, don't know what else to do. They're banging on the doors of the cabin and crew. Yeah, we gotta slow down or we won't make it through. But sleepy riders don't wanna wake or suffer the shock when they put on the brake. Don't wanna question, don't wanna complain. We'd rather keep riding on this runaway.